like in Cuba extraterritorially, if the United States really wanted to slow migration from out migration from Venezuela, it would remove the sanctions because that would be, and the same thing with Cuba. The best way to enable the government of a country to actually focus its resources on helping its own population. But we also see a change in migration from Venezuela to the United States. That is, in the first years of the Chavez regime, and this is something very parallel to migration from Cuba, the first wave of migration from Venezuela was the elite classes who were threatened by the redistributive policies of the Chavez government, and who brought a lot of social capital with them to the United States. Most of those people are now citizens. They tend to be very white, very highly educated, very highly skilled. And they, like those that first generation of Cuban migrants after 1959, in the first years of the 1960s, represent what we could call the Venezuela hawks, the hardcore Republicans. They're the ones who think that the Democrats are communists and who would support a US intervention in Venezuela. They now represent only about 15% of Venezuelan migrants in the United States, but they are the ones who are citizens and who vote. They're mostly located in Florida, and like the Cuban American community there, are very highly organized and certainly have the ear of politicians like Marco Rubio, who obviously holds a high position in the Trump administration. In more recent years, we've seen much larger sectors and much more diverse sectors of the Venezuelan population migrating to the United States. They tend to be less wealthy. First, we see the middle classes, and then we start seeing the poor. Trying to escape the economic crisis, the US-induced economic crisis in Venezuela that is affecting more and more people. So we see more people of color, fewer white people, more poor people, less highly educated people, people from the lower rungs of Venezuelan society. And we also see the numbers greatly increasing. So the Venezuelan immigrant population is quite diverse. They do not all agree with each other. And and we see this in other Latino communities as well, is that those who are citizens tend to hold more anti-immigrant positions and even against immigrants from their own countries. And we know that under the Biden administration, the door was opened to advance parole and easier paths to asylum for large numbers of Venezuelans who were fleeing the Biden administration's own policies and the Obama and Trump administration's own policies. And the pre-existing wealthy white Venezuelan communities were not all happy about this. This was not the Venezuela they wanted to recreate in the United States. They wanted to recreate their elite Venezuela in the United States. So I see a lot of parallels in shifts in Cuban migration and the Cuban American community as what I see in Venezuelan migration and the Venezuelan community. So most Venezuelans in Venezuela overwhelmingly oppose any kind of US military intervention in their country. And most Latin Americans everywhere in Latin America, they know about US intervention and US imperialism, and they do not want to see this. However, among that early generation of Venezuelan migrants, we do see support for US intervention. They are the Marco Rubio contingent, so we do see support there. Yeah, I would love to take some questions.
You're listening to Aviva Chomsky on Gunboat Diplomacy, Then and Now. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Yes, Abby, thank you very much for that interesting overview. I'd be interested in any comments you may have on this year's Nobel Peace Prize, who pooled whose strings in order to get that to happen. And what has been the official reaction within Venezuela to this event, shall we call it?
Maria Machado, who pulled the strings? I have no idea the internal workings of the Peace Prize Committee, who pulled the strings. But certainly, you know, there was a big push, at least by the Trump administration, for Trump to be granted the Nobel Peace Prize. And I almost feel like this was a way of giving it to Trump and looking a little better, because they gave it to a Latin American woman instead of the president of the white man who was the president of the United States. So it gives it a sort of a false progressive aura that they're giving it to a Latin American woman. But it was really a gift to Trump, because Machado represents the far right of the Venezuelan opposition. And the Venezuelan opposition also has several different tendencies in it. But Machado represents the Marco Rubio faction of the Venezuelan opposition, the far right Latin America hawk, a supporter of Netanyahu and Israel's wars of aggression throughout the Middle East, a supporter of Trump, and a supporter of U.S. military intervention in Venezuela. So I think that this was kind of a covert gift to Trump. So that within Venezuela, there is very, very little support for a U.S. military intervention. If the U.S. intervenes militarily, people are going to suffer and people are going to die. No matter whether you love Maduro or hate Maduro, you do not want a U.S. military intervention any more than those of us in this room probably, I'm guessing, that very few of us have much fondness for the Trump administration. And yet, I'm also guessing that none of us want to see a military intervention by some other country to overthrow him. I am guessing that we share the goal of peacefully moving on from a Trump administration to one that we like better. So no matter how much people in Venezuela, and not all people, because there's a variety of views in Venezuela about Maduro, but no matter how much some Venezuelans might hate Maduro and want to see him gone, only very, very few want to see it happen through a U.S. military intervention.
We have a question from Susan online.
Yes, thank you. Avi, thank you very much. My question is, you're highly critical of the United States, as is, protective by the First Amendment. I have no issue with that. But I wonder if you can address the concept of patriotism.
I think personally, I'm much more of an internationalist. And both as a historian and in my lifetime, I have seen so much harm, horrific harm is a kind of a euphemistic word. So many horrific acts committed against human beings in the name of patriotism. And I was in Nicaragua in the 1980s, and that was the first time that I was exposed to what seemed to me to be a positive kind of patriotism, a kind of patriotism that brought people together around an ideal of creating a new kind of country, of liberation, of redistribution, of creating a country that really was with all and for the good of all. But even in Nicaragua in the 1980s, there were some problems with framing this solely inside the ideology of patriotism. Because what about those Nicaraguans, like the Miskito on the Atlantic coast, who were not Spanish-speaking, who did not share this expansive view of Nicaraguan culture and what it was, and the attitude of the Sandinistas towards the indigenous people of the coast was very similar to the attitude of colonizers of indigenous peoples throughout Latin American history and throughout U.S. history. That is, oh, those people are kind of primitive and they need to be taught Spanish and assimilated into Nicaraguan patriotism. We need to teach them how to be Nicaraguans so that we can all have this common identity. Well, that has been a really problematic colonial attitude since European colonialism began. The idea that that multiculturalism and multiple identities are a threat to a common national identity, and that the goal of the government is to eliminate multiculturalism in the name of national unity. So, you know, most anti-colonial liberation movements, like the Nicaraguan Revolution, basically modeled themselves, and like the Latin American anti-colonial revolutions in the early 1800s, like the African liberation movements in the late 20th century, combined internationalist and nationalist ideologies and goals within the same movements. But to me, the most hopeful and most potentially liberatory aspects of those movements was their internationalist vision rather than their nationalist vision. And then if you look at the new countries of Africa, just how damaging that nationalism was to countries that were extremely multicultural and multilingual, and where one ethnic group tries to assert its representation of the nation, excluding other languages and ethnic groups. So nationalism has done too much harm, and nationalism is a European invention of the 1700s, 1800s, and it has always involved repression, exploitation, and destruction. So I have a hard time with nationalism, even though we see examples, liberatory expressions of nationalism. And certainly from the perspective of the United States, I think that patriotism is simply a cover for imperialism and exploitation.
Thank you.
We have a couple of questions from the floor here. First from Calvin.
Hi, Avi. In the very beginning, you spoke about how the United States has always been, from the very beginning, expansionist. And my question is, are the more democratic the target is for a regime change, it seems to me that there are softer targets than autocratic countries, especially if they're left leaning. Could you say something about that? I'm thinking of all the regime change operations that we've been involved in this country in the past several decades. The more democratic that country was, the easier it was to have for NGOs, for example, to influence the politics in that country and to move toward a coup than it would be if the country was more autocratic, that they're better able to resist.
I would frame that differently. I would say that the more democratic a country is, the more threatening the United States finds it, because the more democratic a country is, the less likely it is to cede to U.S. corporate interests, and the more likely it is to actually answer to the interests of its population. So I do think it's true that the United States is more likely to intervene in democratic countries, but I'm not sure that that's because they're softer targets. I think it's because it's more common for the United States to see them as threatening, because the United States, for all its claims to support democracy, especially in the global South, finds democracy very threatening. When the people have a voice in their government and they are able to call for their interests to be represented, and that frequently clashes with U.S. interests and especially U.S. corporate interests. You know, I'm thinking back to the Spanish conquest, where the Spanish confronted many, many different kinds of indigenous social formations when they arrived in the 1500s, some of them quite autocratic, like, say, the Aztec Empire, very hierarchical, very highly militarized, large military forces, and some of them much more democratic, especially the small agricultural villages, hunting and gathering peoples who generally had very democratic forms of governance by consensus, by councils, community councils, by elders, through debate and discussion. Who fell to the Spanish conquerors? It was the highly militarized empires. They were the easiest ones to conquer. Which indigenous peoples took centuries to conquer, and many of whom are still unconquered, were the hunters and gatherers. The ones who were least militarized, least centrally organized, most anarchistic and decentralized, they were the ones who were impossible to conquer. Because even if the Spanish could displace them or take their lands, they simply went somewhere else and continued their livelihoods. It is definitely true that the United States tends to find autocrats more amenable. And when we see examples of them intervening in democratic countries like Iran and Guatemala in the 50s, or Chile in the 70s, or Nicaragua in the 80s, the United States has never had trouble making friends with autocrats. The United States loved Trujillo. They loved the Shah of Iran. They loved Somoza. They loved Pinochet, because they find it easier to ally with autocrats because they are basically pursuing the same goals.
I thank you, and I really appreciate the nuance in your discussion of the dilemmas of nationalism in relation to national liberation. But my question goes back to the seeming precedent of Panama, in that, you know, supposedly tomorrow Maduro is going to be proclaimed by Trump to be the head of a drug cartel, and narco-traficante, setting the grounds for an invasion as an arrest of the head of state as a narco trafficker, which was exactly what was done with Noriega, right, where the pretext for the invasion was, we're going to arrest one man who was actually tried in U.S. court and imprisoned as both a criminal and a POW. It was his recognized status as a prisoner in the U.S. And I wonder, is that just a superficial analogy, or looking with your historian's eye at the precedent of Panama, is there anything that you'd take away from that kind of invasion as arrest and personalization of, we're going to conquer and brutalize the entire country because we've demonized one person? Is there anything we can learn, or that you would say we should learn from that in addressing the situation of a similar, like, demonization of an individual, designating him as a narco trafficker, invading the country to arrest him? What can we learn, or should we learn, from that precedent?
Well, I think there are definitely voices in the MAGA coalition and in the Trump administration that are pushing that analysis that you just articulated, that the United States will be able to do in Venezuela exactly what it did in Panama. And look how successful it was. And you know how successful it was? I think they're basically talking about, you know, was not very costly in terms of American lives. Like, no U.S. administration wants to have another Vietnam where they actually have to mobilize hundreds of thousands of Americans and send them off to war and have them be killed. They want a regime change. And they also don't, Trump does not want another Iraq or Afghanistan. He does not want a long military occupation that, again, is going to be costly in terms of U.S. lives, and that the U.S. population is going to be hard to keep the U.S. population on board with that. And that's not Trump's modus operandi. Like, Panama was a low-cost operation from the perspective of the U.S. administration. That is, not that many Americans were killed. And that's all they care about. They don't care how many Panamanians are killed or how many Venezuelans are killed, unless there's significant opposition in the United States to these horrors, as we've seen in the case of Israel and Gaza. Neither the Biden administration nor the Trump administration cared how many Palestinians were killed. What they cared about was whether there were any voices in the United States raising their voices in opposition, and those voices had to be crushed to prevent anybody from caring about how many Palestinians were killed or even knowing how many Palestinians were killed. But I think it's a very dangerous analogy that is, oh, we can just do in Venezuela what we did in Panama. I mean, Panama had been basically a U.S. client state since 1903. Noriega was also a tool of the U.S. for many years. Panama is a very small country, and the United States has a huge military presence there. Venezuela is not Panama. And if members of the Trump administration are pushing the argument that Venezuela will be easy, just like Panama, I think they're going to be in for some ugly surprises. But I also feel the Trump administration feels like it's kind of on a roll. And I think the Middle East has a lot to do with this. Like, Israel got away with it in Gaza and Lebanon and Syria. And there's really, and we got away with it in Iran. And there's really no one who can stop us. So I think that kind of deluded thinking, and I mean, it's not entirely deluded, because the military imbalance is so huge between the US-Israel axis of evil and every other country in the world, that it's horrifying to think about what the United States might be able to do. And I would hope that we would be able to mount enough opposition in the United States, but I'm not sure we would. And I almost see the president of Gaza as more relevant than the president of Panama.
So I wanted to go back to the questions you raised about Haiti and Louisiana. It was my understanding that the French were planning to use Louisiana to grow the food for Haiti, because Haiti was the incredible profitable sugar production that was almost the basis of the French Empire at that point. And it was the Haitians who handed the defeat to the French that then in turn, then they realized that they didn't have a good use of Louisiana, and they were involved in all sorts of other imperialist wars at the time and had a loose hold on Louisiana. Is that your understanding?
Well, from the perspective of the French, that makes sense. I was thinking about it more from the perspective of the United States, because the Louisiana Purchase is called the Louisiana Purchase, but it was a huge chunk of the American Midwest was the Louisiana Purchase. So I was thinking about, I was answering the question from the perspective of the indigenous population, not the city of New Orleans and the, you know, what's today Louisiana per se, but the entire Louisiana Purchase, which was much bigger than just that. So I was thinking of it from the perspective of U.S. expansion and the native population of that entire area.
One more comment. I think we owe the Louisiana Purchase to the Haitians, and that's never acknowledged.
Yes, I agree with that, but I would phrase it a little bit differently, because you make it sound like the Louisiana Purchase was a great thing, and the Louisiana Purchase was an awful thing for the native populations there. That is, when the French claimed control of it, the native populations could survive. Once the United States claimed it, they were eliminated. They were subject to genocide.
So I want to thank Avi once more for your really incisive, wonderful talk.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
You were just listening to Aviva Chomsky, Gunboat Diplomacy, Then and Now. She spoke in Massachusetts in late November 2025. Aviva Chomsky is a distinguished historian, author, and activist. She's a professor of history and the coordinator of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Winona LaDuke, David Corton, Claudia De La Cruz, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Aviva Chomsky, Gunboat Diplomacy, Then and Now, and for Eduardo Galeano's classic book, Open Veins of Latin America. Call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Jorge Drexler, Movimiento.
Apenas nos pusimos en dos pies, comenzamos a migrar por la sabana, siguiendo la manada de bisontes, más allá del horizonte, a nuevas tierras lejanas. Los niños a la espalda y expectantes, los ojos en alerta, todo oídos, olfateando aquel desconcertante paisaje nuevo, desconocido. Somos una especie en viaje. No tenemos pertenencias, sino equipaje. Vamos con el polen en el viento. Estamos vivos porque estamos en movimiento. Nunca estamos quietos, somos transhumantes, somos padres, hijos, nietos y bisnietos de inmigrantes. Es más mío lo que sueño que lo que toco. Yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco. Yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco. De ningún lado del todo y de todos lados un poco. Atravesamos desiertos, glaciares, continentes, el mundo entero de extremo a extremo, empecinados, supervivientes, el ojo en el viento y en las corrientes, la mano firme en el remo. Cargamos con nuestras guerras, nuestras canciones de cuna, nuestro rumbo hecho de versos, de migraciones, de hambrunas. Y así ha sido desde siempre, desde el infinito. Fuimos la gota de agua viajando en el meteorito, cruzamos galaxias, vacíos, milenios, buscábamos oxígeno. Encontramos sueños. Apenas nos pusimos en dos pies y nos vimos en la sombra de la hoguera. Escuchamos la voz del desafío. Siempre miramos al río pensando en la otra ribera. Somos una especie en viaje. No tenemos pertenencias, sino equipaje. Nunca estamos quietos, somos transhumantes, somos padres, hijos, nietos y bisnietos de inmigrantes. Es más mío lo que sueño que lo que toco. Yo no soy de aquí, pero tú tampoco.
Hi, this is Sukyun Lee. And you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians. The music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs, interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.